It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today's talk is on Bodhidharma's second Bodhisattva precept, no stealing. Here's the precept. Self nature is mysteriously profound. Unattainable Dharma, not to raise mind of attainable, is called no stealing or robbing. So self-nature is mysteriously profound is just saying that our true nature is both profound and mysterious and impossible to understand. And even Dharma, which is reality itself, is unattainable. So not even thinking about attaining is called no stealing or robbing. So I guess that means if you do think about attaining understanding, then that's stealing or robbing. So this is Bodhidharma's ultimate truth statement of the Bodhisattva precept, no stealing. So as we've said, these precepts are unique among religious ethical teachings in that they're based on the experience of no self. And that experience makes all the difference. And this expression of the precept that I just read to you, that's very difficult to understand. Even so, broadens the idea of no stealing, just like with no killing. No stealing, well, we're all one anyway. We're all one interconnected thing. So there's no cutting off that. There's no taking from some other part to bring to our part. It's impossible, actually. That's the actual truth. We think what we think is the actual truth, but that's the actual truth. And that's why we sit to help us soften into understanding that. But what I just said is a little bit too dualistic. It's not really, there's that and there's this. It's all one thing. And even that's hard to understand. Tenshin Roshi Reb says that the great Bodhisattva precept of not stealing continues and extends the practice of the first great precept, not killing, because the first great precept is ultimately an appreciation of the oneness of all life and a meditation on the dependent co-arising of life and death. So the ultimate meaning of the second precept is realized by clearly observing the suchness of mind and its objects. And suchness is a word like thusness or oneness that tries to describe the reality behind our usual perceptions. It's just a word. And it stands for the reality behind our usual perceptions that we can't understand. So suchness is just it's a word we use to stand in for that. I'd like to tell you a story that I think I read in Dogen Shobo Genzo's Suimon Ki, which are notes that his disciple Ajo took when he gave Dharma talks called Teisho in his Zendo. And Ajo took very careful notes. And but because I can't put my hand on it, I'm pretty sure I read it there, but I can't find it. So I have to tell you it by memory. So I may get a few of the details wrong, but you'll get the gist of it. And one thing you need to know is that in Buddhism, there are only three ways to get expelled from the Sangha. One is killing one's father, one is killing one's mother, and one is stealing monastic property. So those are the three big evils that will get you expelled. And that's the end of it. That's all. It's over for you as far as monastic community is concerned. So here's the story. A long time ago in a Zen monastery, there was a well-known Zen master who ordered his Tenzo, the head cook, ordered his cook to prepare very spare and plain meals for the monks. And the monks were always complaining about being hungry, and the food was just always the same. And they complained a lot about that. And one day, the Zen master had to go somewhere and was planning to be away the whole day. And so that day, the Tenzo, the head cook, went into the storeroom and got some noodles and oil and prepared this delicious meal for the Sangha, the monks there. And while they were eating, the Zen master returned. He returned early and pulled the head cook aside. And you have to understand two things. Being a Tenzo is a very highly honored job. So it's not just given to a beginner. The Tenzo is always a very advanced student. So that's number one. And also, a monk basically owns nothing. A monk owns his tattered robes and his eating bowl. And I think a tool to clean his teeth. It's something like that. It's very minimal. So that's all a monk has. And and so this Tenzo is pulled aside and said, "Did you take the noodles from the storeroom for this meal?" "Yes, I did." "You will leave this monastery now and pay back the cost of the supplies that you took immediately." But all he had was his bowl and robes. And all he could do was beg for his food and whatever he needed to pay back the monastery. And so every day he stood on this corner in the village and begged. And one day the Zen master happened to be coming by and saw him and got really angry and said, "Get off that property that belongs to the monastery. Get off right now. And you need to pay rent for the time that you've been standing there on our property." So the monk leaves and he finds other places to beg. And the Zen master also saw him in those other places and was glad that he wasn't using monastic property anymore for his purposes. And the monks tried to persuade the abbot to change his mind and take him back. I mean, after all, he was just doing them a favor. But the abbot was firm. He was adamant that this is how it was going to be. And I think this went on, I'm not sure how long, but like several years. It wasn't just like a day or so. And finally, the abbot allowed him to return. And Dogen, who was relating this story, so Ajo was taking notes on a story Dogen was telling, this story. And Dogen wonders aloud why the Zen master had to be so severe. And his answer was, it was a test. Dogen didn't put it this way exactly, but basically, the Zen master needed to be sure that the mind of this monk was suchness. And if it was, then there was no stealing. And also, the other thing the Zen master was doing was making sure, he probably saw that this monk was going to be a great Zen master himself. Don't forget, he was already an advanced student, being the Tenzo. And he needed to make sure that the karma in that was ensuing on his taking those noodles was completely made up for. And so being that strict of just get out and don't do anything on monastic property, because you're expelled from this monastery, and that's our property, and you can't beg there either. He needed to do that to be sure that the deed of stealing monastic property was repaired entirely, so that he could become a well-known and powerful Zen master, which he did. So what is the suchness of mind and objects? And it's their interdependence. So again, Tenzin Roshi says mind and objects are the same. They're interdependent. So anything we see and our mind are the same. And some say it's just all mind. And objects are anything in the entire universe of experience, like not only material objects, but thoughts, feelings, and even memories as well. So in this context, mind is consciousness, which dependently arises together with objects. So mind and objects have no independent existence. They exist only codependently and cooperatively. So that's what suchness is. And Reb continues, if we continue to be upright, even in circumstances where pain and anxiety are present, eventually the separation between self and other, mind and object, is revealed as insubstantial and ungraspable. He says, when you are fulfilled in this way, you no longer yearn for external objects, and the precept of not stealing is accomplished. For those who wish to practice and realize this great bodhisattva precept of not stealing, Reb is saying, there is an authentic and unsurpassable path offered by the Buddha ancestors of the Zen tradition. It is simply to sit, stand, walk, and even recline with complete gentleness and uprightness in the midst of all other beings. I'm going to read that again. I think it's so beautiful. For all those who wish to practice and realize this great bodhisattva precept of not stealing, there is an authentic and unsurpassable path offered by the Buddha ancestors of the Zen tradition. It is simply to sit, stand, walk, and even recline with complete gentleness and uprightness in the midst of all other beings. And then he tells this story, where this is Reb, he tells it, I've already told you the story, but Reb is telling us, I'm going to tell you again, of the Zen monk poet Ryokan, who lived in a little hut on a mountainside. And on a full moon night, a thief came to visit, and Ryokan wasn't at home. So the thief entered, but he didn't find anything to steal. And Ryokan returned, and seeing the thief said, I'm sorry that you came all this way and you didn't get anything. here, have my clothes. And after he left, Ryokan, standing naked in the moonlight, cried out, poor fellow, he didn't get much. I wish I could give him this full moon too. And I had heard another version where Ryokan goes running after the thief saying, wait, please, here's something else you can take. So, but this is why I'm telling you, Reb says that he was initially attracted to Zen through this story. This is what made him become a Zen student. He says, I was a thief and Ryokan showed me the precept of not stealing. With open eyes, I glimpsed the inconceivable beauty of Ryokan's heart and the suchness of mind and objects. At that time, I felt great affinity with Ryokan, and I wondered how my heart could be more like his. Now I trust that being upright is the gate to Ryokan's heart. Being upright. And Reb has a whole book called Being Upright. And here are Koban Chino Otogawa's quiet words to his Zendo, his students in Sesshin. And he speaks very slowly and without notes. And I think his words always resonate very deeply. So he says, on the subject of no stealing, he says, it is obvious when you take something that does not belong to you or is not given to you, you get in trouble. This is a limited meaning of no stealing. To understand the broader meaning of this precept, think about your existence before you existed and after you will finish existing. In between, we have this issue of no stealing. The subject opens up in a very big way the question of whether our practice and behavior is encouraging life as one identity. In other words, do we possess? In ancient times, all Buddhists, monks and nuns and lay people gave up possessions to experience a deeper understanding about life. There are many ways to exist. Some people are relatively wealthy. Some have a difficult time surrounding themselves with things, and some have no things to take care of. Some want to be satisfied with pleasure as much as they can for as long as it lasts. And Koban continues, to have a human body on this earth is a complete contradiction. We cannot escape from it, and it is a hard phenomena to see through. It has been said that the truth is so profound, it is hard to observe it thoroughly. In every moment, each thing's existence is interdepending beyond our understanding. Sense organs cannot reach the depth of the truth, and yet every day we discover we're still here. As you become aware of yourself, you desire clothes that fit you and nobody but you. Your house, city, country are all familiar, or at least the unquestionably familiar dynamics of your body are realized there. If you were totally in a strange place, unable to understand others, you begin to understand what a different world you have created. When you get into this other strange place, like if we go to Japan, we see what we created in California, our own little understanding of who we are and what our reality is. He says, where you are becomes what you are. Independent interdependency is there as one personality. Independent interdependency is one personality. And I feel sure he's talking about his experience when he first came to the States. And then he continues, the basic recognition of this precept contains the dilemma of possessing everything and anything and possessing nothing. And this is the human contradiction. The more wealth you have, the more effort you need to take care of it. On the other hand, the fewer possessions you have, the more free you are. And one day it all pops and you begin to feel, I'm going to die now. What was this life, running around? It all becomes a very pale memory. And he says that dying people show a very noble face. They have realized the truth of existence. They suffer and suffer with lots of pain in their bodies and many ideas. And finally, they give up everything. Something heavy drops off, everything drops off, and their faces become very relieved, relieved from suffering and very noble in appearance. Zen practitioners are people who go through that kind of experience very often while they are still quite young. They return to life, not in the same place, same time, but very far advanced and very deep concern about things, medicine, meal bowls, clothing, food. They know all of these things are transient materials, so they share them. Buddha's order was like that. And our study is to look into the real meaning, the true meaning of no stealing. The ordinary meaning of stealing is to take something from others, make others' things your own. But together with this meaning, we can observe that what the whole thing is about, something happened and we appeared on this earth in a very small drop of life, which grew up as matter. A little circle of energy appeared in your mother's circle of energy. And when that time came, it started to separate. It looks like two, mother and child, but mother and child cannot be separated. Even if the mother passes away, that mother is the mother of this child always. Yet we think this human being is an individual existence. Because this human shape is dynamic and moves among many things, we do not question that it's separate existence. And finally, he says, it is necessary to find which way you are going to move on this earth, what kind of life you want to create. Eventually, we begin to understand that we are truly an individual existence. And this individual existence is a universal thing in itself. A life of activity becomes a creative art form for you. So study becomes important. Research becomes important. Also communication. All are necessary. Yet this individual existence is inseparable from this universe. So all that is about the kind of ultimate truth idea. But to just ground it into our own daily reality, it's said that not to steal are the subtler and more deeply personal way it's expressed in the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony, not to take what is not given, is a way of living that naturally arises from our Buddha nature. When we are deluded, stealing cannot be stopped. When we awaken, we cannot be forced to steal. And here are some ways we steal indirectly or unconsciously. And they're all rooted in, remember the eight levels of consciousness, and the seventh is the ego consciousness. And all of these ways, I think there are 13 that I'm about to read to you, they're all rooted in self-cleaning, clinging, the seventh level of consciousness. When we studied the precepts before, I had a similar list, which I've made a little more extensive and clear. So ways that we steal, either unconsciously or indirectly. The first is greed. We want something that's not ours, so we take it. It's really basic. The second is anger or resentment. You might feel maligned by somebody and steal something of theirs just to get back at them. But in this case, it's even worse because there's anger. So karmically speaking, you have stealing and anger, and it has more karmic effects that aren't good. The third is convenience. And in this case, I'm thinking of spiritual teachers who have sexual relationships with their students because they're conveniently present and sort of beholden to them. That's convenience. And presumption is another one, using something of someone else's without permission. We presume, oh, it's okay. I'll use that person's thing. Carelessness, like borrowing something and not returning it. Laziness or unwillingness to keep track of small details or to follow an interaction all the way through, which can be preying on the goodwill. So you're stealing goodwill or the other's good impression of you. I think we do that a lot. Inconsiderateness, like being late, which is stealing someone else's time, or saying you'll call back and then disappearing instead while they mentally wait for you, ghosting. And that's done all the time today. It's very painful to see that. Failing to acknowledge help that has been given you or work that has been done for you can be stealing credit that belongs to someone else. Creating a lack of clarity or haziness around what is expected in either large or small agreements can steal from the other person's time and their ability to organize and grow their life. If you're kind of vague, and then the other person thinks you mean one thing and you really mean another, there's all kinds of unclarity that really takes a lot of energy from the other person. I'm rereading Jane Austen's Emma right now, and this lack of clarity is a big one. And she gets herself in mess after mess with lack of clarity. She thinks she's being clear, but she's got it wrong. So in the end, there's so much damage. And so then we're on the 10th one, agreeing to something that you already know you'll not do, takes something from the other person's energy and time and well-intentioned plans. Taking something that was not wholeheartedly given, like sneaking something for yourself, under the rubric of misunderstanding. Being given a position of power or leadership and using it for something else like your own personal benefit. Politicians do this routinely. And finally, stealing life. Stealing from your own life, as well as not behaving in such a way that our planet can survive and flourish. So try to think of some more. Those are 13, but I bet you there's some more. Well, here are the most important points from today's talk. First, for all those who wish to practice and realize this great Bodhisattva precept of not stealing, there is an authentic and unsurpassable path offered by the Buddha ancestors of the Zen tradition. It is simply to sit, stand, walk, and even recline with complete gentleness and uprightness in the midst of all other beings. And I think Reb actually takes this very seriously and tries to live this way in every one of his actions. I've heard stories of at least one person who was just not treated very well by the whole community and was just sitting alone, I think, in the dining room. And no one came to ask about her, but Reb did. Reb came and very gently talked to her and found out, you know, what was going on, and was very compassionate and completely changed her experience. And I think that was a great example to me of how, when he says this, that this unsurpassable path offered by the ancestors of the Zen tradition of being gentle and upright in the midst of all other beings. And that's a way for you to live the rest of your life, really. You don't have to think about anything else, just that, honestly. And there won't be any stealing. Second, and this next one is from Reb also, I was a thief and Ryokan showed me the precept of not stealing. With open eyes, I glimpsed the inconceivable beauty of Ryokan's heart and the suchness of mind and objects, that they're the same. At that time, I felt great affinity with Ryokan, and I wondered how my heart could be more like his. Now I trust that being upright is the gate to Ryokan's heart. And I'm saying that complete gentleness and uprightness is the gate to Reb's heart. I think he's a very great Zen master. And third, to understand the broader meaning of this precept, think about your existence before you existed and after you will finish existing. In between, we have this issue of no stealing. The subject opens up in a very big way the question of whether our practice and behavior is encouraging life as one identity. In other words, do we possess? And possession in that way is a terrific duality. You know, that idea of possession, there's me and there's this object, and it either belongs to me or this other person, and it's all about dualism. Okay, and fourth, it is necessary to find which way you are going to move on this earth. What kind of life do you want to create? Eventually, we begin to understand that we are truly an individual existence. This individual existence is a universal thing in itself. So as we are individual, at the same time, we're universal. A life of activity becomes a creative art form for you. The life you lead, the life you decide that you choose, that you're going to lead, is a creative art form for you. And lastly, this idea that when we are deluded, stealing cannot be stopped. But when we awaken, we cannot be forced to steal. And here are some ideas for your reflection during the week. First, please tell a story of your own stealing, including your state of mind, your life circumstances, your justification, your feelings afterwards, and your feelings about it now when you have more clarity. I think it's really important to examine ourselves and see if we can find moments of either that direct stealing, that like greed, or any of the other, that was the first one, and any of the other 12, or anything you've experienced that's in the realm of conscious or unconscious stealing. So then you tell the story and include your state of mind, your life circumstances, how you justified it, your feelings afterwards and now when you have more clarity. Okay. Second, regarding your own stealing event, as I just related, do you feel the need for a repair? And repairs can be directly to the party involved, or if that's not possible, you can make a repair internally in your heart. When you broaden your conception of stealing, you may have a whole list of occasions that qualify and make amends for the whole list. I did all these things and I'm making amends for all of them. Acknowledging and apologizing for past wrong behavior can be infinitely cleansing and freeing and enlightening. And I would like to invite you to take this opportunity as part of our study to accomplish this for yourself. And third, sometimes our habits can serve as a form of entrenched stealing from our own sense of wholeness and well-being. Most of us have habits as distinguished from daily routines or practices. And so I'm inviting you to think about yours and see if you can pinpoint the ways in which they leak energy and clarity and presence from you. Usually habits are unconsciously based, and so they would leak energy and clarity and presence, which are all, they all require consciousness. And fourth, have you ever had something stolen from you? And rethink that event and see if you can name the feelings and sensations that arose in you as a result. Some of them might be subtle. In other words, I'm inviting you to think about how you felt most of us have had that experience at least once. And then just really, really remember how you felt and go into it so you get to the subtler levels. And then lastly, fifth, how do you steal from the planet? And can you make a vow to cease in at least one way? I wonder if you have questions. Sahar isn't here today, so I'm going to see what the questions are. And there's one. This idea when you were in a totally strange place, unable to understand others, you begin to understand what a different world you have created. When Coben said that, I could really feel how lonely and hard it must have been for him to come here. And not only him, but all the teachers who settled here from Japan, hardly speaking English. It's not really a question, but we do tend to forget. You know, we get so much from these teachers and we forget how, if they could just tell us everything they tell us in Japanese, it'd be nothing for them, but they have to say it all in English. And I think we don't appreciate what a struggle that is. But there's a little regarding Coben Chino. There's a backstory that I can tell you that's really interesting, and it's like everything turns around. So when he Suzuki Roshi, who kind of, you know, not that long or long earlier, not so much earlier, he came from Japan, but he had studied English, so he didn't have that problem. He invited Coben Chino to come to Tassajara to help him. And so he invited Coben, who was at Eheiji. I think I told you about Coben's education, and then he was hired by Eheiji to teach the students forms and ceremonies. And so he was kind of like a novice master also. And so Suzuki Roshi sent two of his foremost students to Japan, to Eheiji, to study and train in like genuine monastic tradition. And the two men he chose, one I think was English, but they were very big, like one I think had been a football player and one was over 6 feet tall. And so at Eheiji, they looked like, you know, total klutzes. I mean, they just really stood out. And the monks, of course, they didn't speak Japanese very well either. And the monks behind their back were totally ridiculing them and laughing at them and mocking them. And Koban heard all this. They were also calling them, I think the word is gaijin, which means barbarians. So these men were basically seen as barbarians. And Koban really felt the unkindness of that. And he took these two guys, you know, under his wing. And he gave them, you know, they had problems with their knees. They needed to go to the doctor or dentist or something like that. They loved to eat chocolate. And so he did everything for them. He took them to the doctor. He helped them see a different way to sit so their knees didn't hurt so much. And he was just very kind to them, and it made a big difference. So when he came to America, his English wasn't very good, and he had to really struggle. But everyone appreciated what he taught us. And I think no one ridiculed him. And I remember, actually, I owe him the beginning of my writing practice, because I started writing haiku while I was there. And I mentioned it to him. And he said, you should make it a practice, write one a day. Maybe I've already told you this, but it was so important to me. But anyway, it's a little history of his empathy in the midst of this whole monastery that was like laughing at the two Americans that Suzuki Roshi chose to send over there. Okay, I guess that's all for that. Thank you. Thank you very much for your empathy.
Gail, there's a question, an additional question in the chat box. Taken to its extreme, not stealing approaches asceticism. You named 13 methods of stealing, and there are more. As a writer, I could steal ideas. How do I deal with feeling guilty about this?
Good question, because I think a lot of people feel guilty, but it really is not useful. You know, it also, one of the ways it's not useful is it misdirects your energy. So you're starting, so all of your energy is on how guilty you feel, and it really should be on how incorrect your view is. And if you could think more about complete gentleness and uprightness in everything that you do, you will not be thinking about guilt. You'll be focused on how you could improve your behavior. But actually, writers and artists steal all the time. And there's a certain level at which, instead of seeing it as stealing, I think that it's possible to see it as a conversation. And I know artists, painters, they study really carefully what other painters are doing. And they definitely take from ideas that they see, but they reinvent them. And and make them, they turn them into something that was not in the original. And then it grows from there. And so it's sort of like, and then the original painter might see that and go from there. It's like a real conversation. And I think writers stealing ideas, I don't think stealing is the right word. It's almost like you heard from this other writer that they're using this kind of way of thinking. And you're going to try out that way of thinking yourself and see what happens. And then if you catch yourself feeling guilty, I would invite you to rethink how you're treating yourself, that you're not treating yourself with gentleness and uprightness. You're not treating your guilt with gentleness and uprightness, and you're not treating the act. Let's say you can't think of it in any other way but stealing, then you can still treat the stealing that is the only thing you can see with complete gentleness and uprightness. And that's Buddhist practice right there. That it doesn't go any further than that. That's it, honestly. That's because we have these encounters with ourselves, minute by minute, if we're really paying attention, that your mind wanders and then you're not present and you have to pull yourself back and like, what were you thinking about? And it might not have been anything about what you wanted to be thinking about. And anyway, we do this all the time. So it's important to treat ourselves with this, as even in every minute, as we're standing, sitting, walking, and even lying down, treating ourselves with gentleness and uprightness, as well as we can to treat others that way also. And when we don't, we treat our failure with gentleness and uprightness. I hope that's clear. I hope that answered your question. Thank you.
Here's another question, Gail. There are people who steal other people's ideas. So how do you know the difference if you should stop or do as you just explained? This may be the same person. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's okay. Stealing ideas is stealing, but I'm saying that you can also see it as a conversation that another writer had this idea, and you're kind of riffing off of it is another way, is a more gentle way to talk about it to yourself. And riffing off of another artist, and writers are artists, it's the big conversation of art. It's really the big conversation of art. And without that, art won't grow and develop. We need to riff off each other. We really do. Musicians do it beautifully. So that's why I'm saying to be treating yourself with complete gentleness and uprightness, even if you insist that it's stealing, even if in your heart you can't get to the place where you can see it as a conversation with artists, that artists in as a group converse through seeing or taking ideas that they notice, and then using that. It's like seeing a recipe that someone else cooked, and then taking it, but you add some other ingredients and you bake it instead of fry it or whatever. It's just a conversation. And then someone else does that with your work too. And that's also a conversation. But if you can't get yourself to see that, then you still need to be really gentle and upright with your treatment of yourself. That's all I'm saying. It's really important, because this guilt, what does guilt do? It just makes you miserable. It doesn't help the other person, and it doesn't change any of your circumstances. The other thing you can do is confess and regret. And I think I've given everybody my own prayer for that, confession and regret and regretness. But you can find them if you don't remember mine. But it's really, confession is really, I think it's one of the most important acts in all of Buddhism. And it's not only in Buddhism, it's in Christianity and other religions also. It's very cleansing. Is there another question?
Sorry, there's not. There was a clarification, just that was a separate person asking the second question.
Oh, okay.
So more than one person interested in that. But that's all for the chat box questions.
Well, I'm almost out of time, and I just want to say one more thing about yesterday at this one day sitting with Reb. And he often organizes his whole, not only one day sitting, but sort of the section of the year, like this is the part of the new year. He'll organize it around one thought. And the thought I just want to convey to you, because it's really a good one for the new year. And yesterday was a kind of New Year's ceremony honoring our teacher. And that felt very wonderful. We were able to write a letter to him in advance, expressing our appreciation for him and his teachings, and wishing that he will continue to teach again and again and again for years. But his thought yesterday was, we all need to know what is the very most important point in our life that we want to express and complete our work on as much as possible, that we want to use our energy for. What is the one important point of our life right now? What is the one important point? And we all need to know it. And I've kind of talked about this before, but I don't think I was ever that clear. What is the one important point of your life right now? And that you should know it and examine how well you're organizing your life around it. And if you're not completely there, dedicate this year to getting completely there. Those weren't exactly his words, but it was his intention to have all of us be focused on what is the most important point right now for our lives. And I wanted to pass that on to you. I thought it was very profound and timely. And so now it's timely to thank everyone. My team, Brian and Sahar, who's not here, but she's thinking of us, and Brendan, and all of you who make these talks possible, and those who listen at times, not today. I thank you all very much, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.